This week on Double Down Newswatch. In a week where the news has been dominated by the stabbing of two Jewish men in North London, we look at a stabbing 5 days earlier the media has entirely ignored, and we meet the victim. The almost unimaginable barbarity of Israeli detention centres. We expose the crime Western media still refuses to report. My colleague Lorna Hosford will be here with a summary of the news in brief, and we offer a preview of this week's epoch-defining local elections in the UK. I'm Richard Sanders, and this is your weekly look at the world through independent eyes. Today is the start of what we hope will be a new era in British journalism. Double Down Newswatch will provide you with a one-stop shop, a showcase for the best of independent media, breaking free of the agenda set by mainstream outlets and offering an alternative perspective on world affairs. Never before has it been more needed, as the events of recent days have shown. Last week, the Jewish community of Golders Green in northwest London was traumatised by the horrific stabbing of two men. It quickly became clear the assailant was mentally ill. He'd earlier attacked a non-Jewish man in South London. All three victims survived. There was little to suggest the attacker was part of any broader terrorist or political group. But coming in the wake of a series of attacks on Jewish property, the stabbings were given wall-to-wall coverage by UK media. The existence of the non-Jewish victim effectively erased in much of the reporting, and even by the police, who announced he'd been charged following the stabbing of two men rather than three. The incident prompted a chorus of demands from across the political spectrum for a crackdown on demonstrations against the genocide in Gaza, termed hate marches, including from Reform Party leader Nigel Farage.
I'm afraid we have allowed marches to take place, with chants being heard over the streets of London and other cities, and we've not acted, and the government has been weak, weak, weak on all of this.
Farage, of course, was recently exposed as having been, at least in his youth, a crude and extreme anti-Semite. Just in case Jewish people weren't terrified enough, on Sunday, Trevor Phillips launched an extraordinary monologue at the start of his show on Sky.
There are people in this nation right now hunting Jews for no other reason than that they are Jews. Everything else is just a way of justifying their persecution. There's a grim guessing game being played out in some Jewish households, I'm told. The family debates who among their Gentile friends would have protected them from persecution a century ago, and who would have turned their backs for fear of being ostracized themselves. The question being asked is, would they hide me?
Phillips went on to pressure his guests to call for restrictions on anti-genocide protests. Now, in relation to Trevor Phillips, I just want to show you a series of quotes and ask you, do you think they're anti-Semitic? The decision to put a five-year-old Christian girl into Jewish foster care is like child abuse. To some Jewish men in Germany, basic norms of decent behaviour are irrelevant. Jews are a nation within a nation. The integration of Jews will probably be the hardest task we've ever faced. It will mean abandoning the milk-and-water multiculturalism still so beloved of many and adopting a far more muscular approach to integration. The answer is that, of course, they're anti-Semitic. These were all comments made by Trevor Phillips, except, of course, he made them not about Jews, but Muslims. I'll simply leave them there for a bit, and you can decide for yourself how much weight you attach to Trevor Phillips' views on racism. The only leading politician to push back was the only Jewish leader of a British political party, Zach Polanski of the Greens, who accused the government of using the pain of the Jewish community to restrict our right to peaceful protest. In the looking-glass world of British politics, Polanski quickly found himself a target. He was abused in the street.
You little weasel! How dare you! You're supposed to be Jewish! Your mum, Eva, and your dad, Philip. You're like a crackhead.
Later the same day, he was subjected to Nazi salutes. The Times printed a cartoon so crudely anti-Semitic, it was withdrawn within a matter of minutes. Most disturbingly, when Polanski shared a post on social media criticising the methods used to arrest the Golders Green attacker, he was subjected to an extraordinary public rebuke from the head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Mark Rowley. Rowley not only criticised him for interfering in operational matters, for which Polanski later apologised, but also for failing to show sufficient solidarity in confronting anti-Semitism, a highly unusual political intervention in the week before national elections. Rowley then doubled down on national television, adding his voice to those urging restrictions on the right to protest.
I'm really troubled by what we've seen is many of these marches, they set out with an intent to march near synagogues, etc., and every single time we put conditions on to prevent that. But even that intent causes me concern that they repeatedly ask to do such things.
This is simply not true, along with much else that's been said in the last week. It's important to remember that what's being proposed here is restrictions on the right to protest genocide, the killing of at the very least 72,000 people, close to a third of whom are children. We're talking tens of thousands of small children maimed, mutilated and murdered, killings in which Britain is complicit through surveillance flights and arms supplies. Restricting the right to protest is a serious curtailment of British civil liberties. We feel it's vital that you, the public, are in possession of accurate information. My colleague Lorna Hosford has pulled together a very basic fact check.
The so-called hate marches have been running since the start of the genocide in October 2023, and cumulatively many millions of people have taken part. The Met Police have not released relevant arrest data for over a year. However, their records show that from October 2023 to March 2025, the demonstrations resulted in only 526 arrests, with 117 of those being released without charge. The only significant violence was caused by right-wing counter-demonstrators, led by the far-right leader Tommy Robinson in November 2023. A large Jewish contingent is present at every demonstration. And as for Police Commissioner Mark Rowley's claim that demonstrations repeatedly set out with an intent to march near synagogues, this is flatly denied by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Rivka Bernard, its deputy director, says, "None of our marches or proposed march routes have ever targeted a synagogue or even directly passed one along its route. And the Met Police knows that. The organisation has sent a formal complaint to Mark Rowley." When the police banned a demonstration outside of the BBC because there was a synagogue nearby, Double Down News revealed that it was in a back street, 5 minutes walk away. The primary allegation of anti-Semitism is that some demonstrators chant, "Globalise the Intifada," and "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Intifada means uprising or shaking off and does not necessarily imply violence. The first Intifada in Palestine was non-violent. It comprised of strikes, demonstrations, and boycotts. For Palestinians, these are calls for solidarity and for freedom and democracy for all in Israel and the occupied territories. They would point out there is an obvious irony that they are being accused of racism at the very time Israel is brutally inflicting what most experts agree is genocide in Gaza and ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, in a bid to firmly establish what all the world's leading human rights organizations agree is an apartheid regime, from the river to the sea. In an interview with the Sunday Times, referring to a recent spate of attacks on Jewish properties, Rowley said, "If that had been a different minority group, you can imagine a wholly different scale of response in terms of public debate." Again, this is simply untrue. The Muslim Council of Britain has identified at least 28 attacks on mosques across the UK since the start of 2025, and none of them received prominent mainstream news coverage. And finally, Mark Rowley has diverted the annual Nakba Day march in London on May 16th, held to commemorate the expulsion of Palestinians from Palestine in 1948, to accommodate an actual hate march led by Tommy Robinson. Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the opposition Conservative Party, said she also sees Robinson's demo as less of a threat.
"Would you consider taking similar action against the march that's planned for the same day as the pro-Palestinian march, May the 16th, the rally being organised by Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, Tommy Robinson, a convicted far-right activist? Would you consider banning that too?"
Well, is he creating a climate of intimidation and violence?
I'll leave you with some clips from last time Tommy Robinson organised a march in London, and you can judge for yourself which is the hate march.
"But it's not just Britain that's being invaded. It's not just Britain that's being raped. Every single Western nation faces the same problem. An orchestrated, organised invasion and replacement of European citizens is happening.
We've got to clean our countries up. We've got to get everything out that does not know or receive Jesus Christ. Ban halal, ban burqas, ban mosques, ban temples, ban shrines. We don't want those in our countries.
It's either now or never. Because if these rapist Muslims take over, they will not only rape your women, they will behead your sons. So we either fight now or we die.
There's genuine risk of rape and murder and the destruction of the country and dissolution of the entire way of life. Whether you choose violence or not, violence is coming to you. You either fight back or you die.
Thank you, Lorna Hosford, for that. That is what you call journalism. It's really not difficult. As so often, many of the voices pushing back most powerfully against the general hysteria were Jewish. Zach Polensky, and also Rabbi Herschel Gluck, president of the Shomrim, the Jewish police in Stamford Hill in northeast London, who gave an extremely powerful interview to the journalist Owen Jones. It's worth running at length.
I find this very difficult to understand. What is the connection between the protests and the person who tried to kill two Jews yesterday? There's no logical connection at all. It's a total leap of faith. And therefore, it is very disturbing that politicians are using Jewish suffering as a weaponized lever for their own pet projects. And this is out of order. The right to protest, the right to of expression, are very fundamental rights in Britain and for humanity.
Rabbi Herschel Gluck there, a rare voice of sanity who you certainly won't see anywhere near mainstream media. To be clear, in the current febrile political atmosphere, the security Jewish communities needs to be taken very, very seriously by the media, by politicians, and above all, by the police, who need to target resources rationally and forensically and not allow themselves to be distracted by what are very, very obviously political agendas, many aimed at demonizing and delegitimizing the struggle against apartheid and genocide in Palestine. There was another stabbing in London last week. It's likely you haven't heard about it, as it went entirely unreported. The victim was this man, Mohammad Raza. He's a supporter of the Iranian government. Raza's seen here a few days before the stabbing with his children being harangued and abused by an Iranian monarchist. Raza says the man abusing him was carrying an Israeli flag. The stabbing happened on April 23rd in Whitehall in central London. The aftermath was captured on camera. Independent journalist Crispin Flintoff was also filming and came into the Double Down Newswatch studio to tell us what happened. What was this event you were filming at?
It's the first pro-Iran event, protest that I'd seen, and it was opposite Downing Street. There was quite a big crowd of people supporting the Iranian government. Probably about 100 yards down the road, there's an even bigger crowd of pro-monarchist, pro-Israel, pro-US. They combined all these flags together, making a lot of noise, having a bigger PA than the pro-Iran crowd that I was with, and being quite intimidating. And some of them were allowed to come into the protest for Iran, and just harangue and hassle people.
So what happened?
There was a disturbance near to where we were assembled, and everyone ran off. The person I was talking to said, is there a doctor around? We all ran to see these two men who'd been stripped down. One of them had a bloody nose.
So who were they?
They were the two people who had attacked one of the people at this protest. And then just further down the road was the person who they'd attacked, with knife wounds across him. Clearly, I mean, in trauma, it's a pretty scary situation. I've never seen anything like that at a protest in in London before. I've been to quite a few of them.
Does it look as if the guy was who was stabbed at the demonstration was targeted specifically?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There's no doubt that this was a what you could be called a terrorist attack, if you want, because it was about... It wasn't a random attack. It wasn't someone who was coming out of a mental institution. These were people who had targeted this man deliberately.
Now, you know, this is a quite brutal stabbing in broad daylight in central London. Has mainstream media shown much interest in acquiring your footage?
I haven't heard anything from them. No, nothing. No, not a peep.
Has it been picked up by mainstream media at all, this story?
No. The media had no interest in an attack opposite Downing Street. Opposite Downing Street.
We did something no other media outlet has done. We tracked down the victim.
I'm not feeling very well. It's because of my hand, because of my body, and now I'm in the process of getting better. On the day of the attack, many were pointing at me. I went towards them. Suddenly, I saw a lot of laughter and something. One of them came from the side and from the mouth of a tunnel came and hit me. And by then, I realized I took my phones out of my pocket, recorded a video, and then they attacked. I put my phone in my pocket and I don't understand how I defended myself. I just realized that my whole body was bloody. I am very, very upset with the English police, and it's because they treated me very badly in the hospital and practically detained me. They said, you have to come to the police station, and in that condition, they put me in a van. In that same condition, they took me to the police station. We were outside the police station for about 2 or 3 hours before they took me inside. And even there, they didn't let me talk to my children. And at 2 in the morning, even though I was upset, very upset with them, they left me right in front of the police station.
I understand there is a difference between the two cases. The random stabbing of individuals, apparently on the basis of their ethnicity, is more newsworthy than a stabbing at a political rally. It's the scale of the disparity that is so jarring. On the one hand, wall-to-wall coverage. The government calls an emergency Cobra meeting. The Prime Minister makes an address to the nation. On the other, absolutely nothing. Imagine Mohammad Reza had been a pro-Israel demonstrator stabbed at a demonstration outside the Israeli embassy, or even an Iranian monarchist stabbed by a supporter of the Iranian government. We all know how different the reaction would have been. But there's another difference as well. Mohammed's stabbing was a vicious, targeted attack. The assailant in gold as green was mentally ill, and there's a pattern here. A few months ago, a number of people were stabbed on a train near Peterborough. The media went into overdrive, treating it as an asylum seeker story. When it turned out the knifeman was not an asylum seeker, and in fact the man who had stopped him was, the media lost interest. Invariably, when the dust settles, these turn out to be stories that are as much about mental health as anything else, and the chronic underprovision and under-resourcing of mental health services in the UK. I feel very strongly about this. 150 years ago, people began to look at small children living on the streets and said, this is just wrong. Every day on my way to work, I pass people who are clearly mentally ill, living in destitution on the streets. We ought to be saying that this has no place in a civilized society. And when a tiny proportion of mentally ill people commit acts of violence, as they inevitably will, we need to be able to have an intelligent and humane conversation about it. Sadly, at present, this seems to be something Britain's media and political class is entirely incapable of. We turn now to the Middle East. Power plus impunity leads to abuse, and abuse unchecked almost always becomes sexual abuse. This is true throughout history, it's true throughout the world, and it's certainly been true in Israel over the last 2.5 years. There is now reams and reams and reams of evidence of sexual abuse in Israeli detention centres since October the 7th. Now, it wouldn't be true to say that Western media has not reported this. It has. But the contrast with the reporting of alleged sexual abuse by Palestinians on October the 7th is extraordinary. I made a film for Al Jazeera's investigative unit called October 7, and we looked into this in enormous depth. There, the coverage was wall-to-wall. It was continuous. It was graphic. It was lurid. It was highly emotive. And it played a key role in creating the emotional environment which made possible the genocide, despite the fact that if you looked at it very carefully, the evidence was flimsy. And although sexual violence by the Israelis in detention centres is reported in the West, there remains one crime that is taboo for Western media. I first reported it in my film, Gaza, for Al Jazeera's investigative unit in October
2024. إجا كابتن كان موجود إجا زي وضع مادة إشي حاجة إشي يعني عن مؤخرة الشر وأطلقوا كان في كلب موجود أطلقوا عليه الكلب كلب هذا يعني كيف أقول لك مش مارس الجنس اغتصب الشاب اغتصبوه في معنى الكلمة اغتصاب تام.
That was pretty much the first report of the Israelis' use of dogs to rape Palestinian inmates, and it was predictably ignored in Western media. I spoke to a remarkable woman. Her name is Maha Husseini. She's the head of media at an NGO called Euromed Human Rights Monitor, which last month produced a report called Another Genocide Behind Walls, which contains detailed evidence of the use of sexual violence by the Israelis in detention centres. Maha has been in Gaza since day one of the genocide, and she's been displaced 8 times. She spoke to us from Gaza City. Your organisation, Euromed Human Rights Monitor, has produced this extraordinary report, Another Genocide Behind Walls, which looks particularly at the use of sexual torture in Israeli detention centres. Can you summarise for us very briefly what that report says?
Yeah, this report is actually the outcome of work we've been doing since the beginning of the genocide. Overall, we documented at least 7 forms of sexual violence practiced against Palestinians in Israeli places of detention, including rape, cases of rape, threats of rape, forced nudity, assaults on genitals, verbal and physical harassment, and coerced exposure to rape, where the Israeli, of course, officers and soldiers actually force Palestinians to witness the rape of other inmates or other detainees. Of course, the majority of these testimonies actually belong to men other than women. And this is this does not mean that women did not or were not subjected to sexual violence as much as men. But because we are speaking about a conservative society where women actually don't feel very comfortable speaking about being subjected to sexual violence. Many men described being raped several times over the course of several days.
One thing that leaps out of your report is the use of dogs to rape male detainees. There's other evidence around this now as well. How solid and widespread is the evidence for that particular crime now?
Yes, actually, this is not the first time that we documented cases of dogs abusing or trained dogs actually abusing or raping Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. In this report particularly, we documented several cases. I will just read one of the shocking cases that we documented. One detainee told us that he was detained, of course, in Sdeitiman, and this is where most of the violations occur. He said that they took a group of detainees and me to the corridor between the sections and forced us to strip completely naked. The soldiers brought in several dogs. One of them urinated on me. One of the dogs then raped me, penetrated my anus in a trained manner when I was being beaten. This continued for several minutes. I felt profoundly humiliated and violated. Other, of course, men, we met said that after they were raped by the soldiers, they also were raped by dogs in the very same day. And this is something that also confirms that this is a systematic policy, because no army trains dogs on raping humans unless this is something that is accepted by the highest rank in the authority.
These are almost unimaginably horrific accounts, aren't they, Maha? But thank you very much for joining us, and keep
safe.
Thank
you, Richard.
I also spoke to a former Israeli army intelligence officer who has done the work that Western journalists have not, and brought together and collated all of the evidence about the Israelis' use of dogs to rape Palestinian inmates. His name is Shael Ben Ephraim, and he spoke to us from California, where he now lives.
It really started by accident well over a year ago when a friend of mine, childhood friend actually, was stationed at this Detayman base. And at that time, I was a fairly passionate Zionist, supporter of Israel. And he told me, listen, there's things going on in this Detayman prison that you will absolutely not believe. They're so awful. And so I looked into it, and he put me in touch with two guards who had worked there. And they told me about all the torture that had occurred in Detayman, but also some things that hadn't appeared in the media, like the fact that they were killing inmates and leaving them around the others in order to serve as a warning to them and that sort of thing. And I published it on X, and it got a pretty big response. And that played a very large role in my moving away from Zionism. I kept in touch with one of the two guards. I was introduced to another by the guard that I had talked to. I had seen the reports that dogs had been used to sexually assault inmates in Sde Teiman. So I just asked them about it. And to my, surprise, horror, they both confirmed it. One said that he'd seen dogs being used, and the other said that he'd heard talk about dogs being used. From my experience, when inmates in Israeli prisons testify to something, it is true. And it almost always is confirmed by the fact after Zionists and Israel supporters deny it and say that it's just hearsay. It's almost always supported by the facts. Believe the victims, especially when there's several testimonies.
I'm particularly drawn to this subject because I reported this in my film Gaza for Al Jazeera's investigative unit. Back in October 2024. Now, at that time, it was pretty much the first report that was out there in the public about the use of dogs to rape Palestinian prisoners. The work you've done, you've essentially collated, brought together what is out there in the public domain since. Could you just sort of sum that up for us? How much evidence is there now out there in the public domain about this?
Well, as far as I know, there's testimony from at least 20 people. And then I added the testimony of two guards. So that was the first sort of corroboration by any Israeli sources. I was very skeptical about this early on. It sounds to Israelis like something that would be just invented to make Israel seem like the deepest, darkest, most demonic country in the world. You know, we're used to thinking the whole world is anti-Semitic and out to get us. But the testimony is consistent. It's believable. And guards confirmed it to me. So I'm convinced. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see someone boasting about this. We've already had some cases of settlers and soldiers arresting Palestinians and threatening them that they will be raped and that they will be raped by dogs, specifically.
Because we had that case, again, at Sde Teiman, where a rape was caught on video and it was exposed in Israeli media, wasn't it? Now, what's happened to the soldiers involved in that? As I understand it, the charges have been dropped, haven't they?
Yes, the charges were dropped. The only person who faced real consequences for that was Yifat Yerushalmi, the military attorney who leaked the video.
How just some of the cases you have collated are quite extraordinary.
One man who was raped by a dog, he recalled that when he screamed, the guards beat him for disturbing the dog. Another victim, he emphasized that the dog appeared trained and knew exactly what it was doing. Is this systematic, or are these rogue elements?
It's clearly systematic. I don't believe that Netanyahu and Katz ever sat there and decided that dogs should be used to rape inmates. What I think happened is that some commanders who were in charge of the dogs thought this would be a good idea. They did, and no one stopped them. These cases are almost exclusively in Sde Teiman that I'm aware of. There are a couple of cases elsewhere. So it's systematic. It's Sde Teiman for sure. And anything that happens in Sde Teiman tends to spread elsewhere. That's sort of ground zero.
You've served in the Israeli military in intelligence. You're an Israeli. You're brought up in Israel. Explain to us how people can arrive at a place where they are prepared to do this sort of thing and to tolerate those around them doing this sort of thing.
Well, as a disclaimer, I want to say that I haven't lived in Israel since October 7th. And I think that's important because that's kept me separated from a certain psychosis that the Israeli people have undergone. The hatred towards Palestinians in general is incredibly high, but the people who actually perpetrated October 7th, or so we even suspected of perpetrating October 7th, is at levels that are psychotic. Doing this sort of thing with dogs sends a message to Palestinians that the worst things in the world will happen to them unless they leave.
Shail, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thank you. A pleasure.
The treatment of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention centers is almost unimaginably barbaric. And because of the work of people like Shail and Maha, no one can say they didn't know. The failure of Western governments to bring any meaningful pressure on the Israelis over this issue is simply grotesque. Next, a section we call Double Take. Each week we'll be presenting a selection of the most striking stories from independent and social media. It's presented by my producer, Lorna Hosford.
Novaya Media has revealed that the police will not open investigations into 10 British nationals accused of war crimes while fighting for the Israeli forces, despite 240 pages of evidence delivered by a team of legal experts last year. This comes after it emerged that the UK Foreign Office has quietly shut down its in-house unit, whose job it is to log Israeli war crimes. As a result, the government will lose access to a database of 26,000 verified incidents, a resource the government's own counterterrorism unit says is vital if ever the government should seek to prosecute Israeli war crimes. Western media rarely broadcasts them. We will, along with videos from Palestinian sources. The clips I'm going to show you now all come from the last couple of weeks. Warning, many of them are disturbing. Starting in southern Lebanon, numerous videos document the destruction of entire villages. Here, Israeli forces destroy an ambulance. Here, they destroy solar panels. Here, IDF soldiers are mocking and rummaging through a Lebanese woman's clothing drawers, a repeat of the dehumanization we saw enacted in Gaza. Over in Gaza, this Israeli soldier is proudly showing off the total destruction of the town of Beit Hanun. Here, CCTV captures a strike on four unarmed men. We have paused the clip just before impact. And finally, from the West Bank, this clip shows a Palestinian child with Down syndrome being chased, dragged, beaten, and abducted by Israeli soldiers during a raid on a refugee camp near Jerusalem. While the UK appears indifferent to Israeli war crimes, the former director of Israel's Mossad intelligence agency, Tamir Pardo, has likened the settler violence to the behavior of the Nazis. It's worth bearing in mind that were this former head of the Mossad a member of the UK Labour Party, these comments would see him expelled for anti-Semitism. And now some stories from independent media. Deborah Francis White in The Nerve reports on a horrific online rape academy where thousands of men learn how to drug and sexually assault their wives and girlfriends. Now, this story was originally reported on CNN, But Francis White points out that it's been almost entirely ignored and only really picked up on social and independent media. Decent men need to show their outrage, she says. Next, Nick Dearden at Tribune magazine reveals that big pharma firms pulled £2 billion in investments from Britain last year, describes a sinister orchestrated campaign to blackmail the NHS and drive up drug prices. Pharmaceutical multinationals say that Britain is no longer competitive, rhetoric echoed by Donald Trump, who's taken aim at freeloading countries that don't pay lower prices for drugs than the US. Dearden says that the trade pact Keir Starmer signed with Trump last year means that we will be handing over an extra £9 billion a year to Big Pharma by 2035. In Wired magazine, Maddie Varner reports that the US Department of Homeland Security demanded Google hand over the location and activity data of a Canadian man who hasn't entered the US in more than a decade, after he criticized the Trump administration online following the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preti by federal immigration agents in Minneapolis earlier this year. The demand for the man's location data was included in a request DHS issued to Google called a customs summons, which is supposed to be used to investigate issues relating to importing goods and collecting custom duties.
Finally, we look forward to this week's local elections in the UK. We're aware Double Down has millions of international viewers, and this might seem very parochial. Bear with us. These elections will be seismic. Since the First World War, the UK has been dominated by the two-party system of Labour and the Conservatives. This almost certainly comes to an end this Thursday. Both are expected to be decimated, particularly the ruling Labour Party. It's a defining moment. I spoke first to Andrew Feinstein, who stood against the Prime Minister as an independent in the last election and has been campaigning in his constituency.
So, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. Andrew, you stood against Keir Starmer at the last election. You had sort of 6 weeks to prepare for that and I think got 17% of the vote.
19.
Terribly sorry. And you're very involved in politics in that constituency, which is Holborn and St Pancras, Camden, yeah, essentially in North London. Now, you're not standing for the council, but you're involved with groups that are,
yeah,
running in the council elections on May the 7th. How's it going?
So it's going incredibly well. So we're running six candidates in two wards, the wards in which I did best against Keir Starmer. We're also supporting the Green candidates in all of the other wards in the borough of Camden. And the Greens are not standing candidates in the two wards that we're contesting. So we have a cooperative relationship, which I think is very healthy.
So that's very interesting, the deconfliction with the Greens. Are you aware of that happening elsewhere in London?
I'm aware of similar arrangements in at least two or three other boroughs in London. We believe that politics can be done differently. For instance, in the national election, we knocked on 52,000 doors in the constituency, and I had the experience of some people answering the door and asking me what I was doing at their door. And I said, well, do you not think it's a good idea that politicians who want to represent you should be talking to you about what the issues are in your local community? And a lot of people said to me, yes, but I never see my councillors. I don't know who my MP is. And Keir Starmer was running to be Prime Minister and had been their MP for almost 10 years at this point. So I think Keir Starmer is seen as a person who is profoundly untrustworthy. And I think people are fed up with and cynical of our political elite. Related to that is the fact that Starmer himself, he has great difficulty interacting with people and is terrible at it, which is a difficulty for a politician. So that when you actually have contact with him in person, you come away liking him less than you did before you had met him. And then there's the actual politics, which are just horrible. And, you know, the most obvious case to take on this would be the two things that his backers are most concerned with. No significant progressive tax on the wealthy, certainly no wealth tax. And then, of course, the second issue is Israel and Palestine.
How much did Gaza come up on the doorstep in Camden?
Both in the general election of 2024 and in the local election today, it comes up constantly. I would say it comes up in probably 60% of the conversations.
It's interesting how wedded they seem to be to support for Israel at a time when it's clearly very unpopular and massively unpopular with the sort of people who might vote Labour. And they're almost trapped, aren't they? Because it was baked into the sort of creation process of Starmerism, of McSweeneyism. They achieved power by weaponising anti-Semitism.
You can see that there are certain people who have come through this wave of so-called Starmerism. Their instinct is anybody who says anything they don't like, especially about Israel, is immediately an anti-Semite. Which, you know, as a Jewish person who's experienced anti-Semitism, as the son of a Holocaust survivor, as someone who's lectured at Auschwitz, where my mom lost a lot of her family, one of the things that that has done is rendered the entire idea, the entire notion of anti-Semitism meaningless. Keir Starmer, as leader of the Labour Party, has expelled more Jewish members than all other leaders of the Labour Party put together, supposedly in the name of combating anti-Semitism. Now, this is a nonsense.
And you would think it would set enormous alarm bells ringing in the media, but it doesn't. No one. You point this out to people and they say, really? You know,
we have this sort of almost conspiracy of silence, which sometimes merges with a conspiracy of lies. And unfortunately, it comes from our political elite and it is backed up by the media, who either repeat those lies or echo, absurdly, the silence, but who don't challenge our political elite.
Which is why people have to watch Double Down News.
Well, absolutely. I mean, my feeling is that the mainstream and commercial media is on borrowed time, as is our political system, because it's so clearly not fit for purpose.
Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
To get a broader view of what to expect on Thursday, I spoke to Andrew Murray from the Morning Star.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You are the Westminster correspondent of the Morning Star.
Yeah.
You also worked in Jeremy Corbyn's office, didn't you?
I did. My substantive job was Chief of Staff of Unite the Union, but I was seconded for part of the week to work with Jeremy and his team.
Now, I was particularly keen to talk to you. I remember you and I first met when I was making the Labour files for Al Jazeera's investigative unit. I had a fascinating conversation with you where really for the first time somebody absolutely sort of number crunched around the elections. And it was the first time I'd really grasped why Jeremy Corbyn's office was so terrified of the Remain movement.
It was easy to work out that by going down the Remain or the rerunning the referendum route, Labour would lose more or less exactly the seats it did lose in the 2019 elections.
Basically, I want you to do a similar feat of number crunching for me now. I want to get down in the weeds, get forensic. As the results come through, what will you be looking for?
I think the most important thing for the Labour Parliament is what happens here in London, because this is the real remaining Labour heartland. We have elections for the Scottish Parliament. Labour looks like it's going to struggle to come third. But Labour has lost Scotland before. Wales, Labour will do disastrously. That is historic in the sense that Labour has come first in every election of any sort in Wales for more than 100 years. In a way, it's an extension, with Welsh differences, of the loss of the Red Wall, because those South Wales seats, very similar demographic, very similar industrial history. But it's London where Labour has its huge base. It's 49 out of 72 constituencies of Labour held. And you see, what's true of London is also true of the big English cities outside London, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Sheffield and so on. Even in 2019, Labour won all but one of those seats, lost one in Birmingham. And so these urban seats, which are a mixture of, you know, professionals who are finding life much harder than their parents did, young people that can't get a footing on either the housing or the jobs market, together with large, traditionally Labour voting ethnic minority communities, that sort of mixture, as well as part of the sort of what we call the traditional working class, that mixture delivers, you know, probably about 120 seats to Labour. If London goes, a lot of Labour MPs are going to think it's almost game over, you know, and what they hoped was a new career in politics is going to be a very short career break from whatever they were doing before.
In terms of council seats lost, what's the line where we switch from just about acceptable to the Labour Party to absolutely disastrous?
Well, I think Labour are trying to talk now, try and spin it at around 1,000 seats. If Labour is to lose less than 1,000 seats across the country, that's not just London, obviously, it's everywhere, then they will try and spin that as not so bad, more like traditional midterm blues. If it starts creeping upwards, 1,300, 1,400, 1,500, then it becomes disastrous.
So this idea that they're trying to push, that this is conventional midterm blues and will bounce back, it doesn't work, doesn't it? If you look at the Labour polling figures, and they are stuck around 16, 17, 18, 19%. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was never anything like that low.
No. I mean, it's absolutely absolutely new territory. And we have this confluence of, I think, two factors: a long-term undermining of Labour's traditional social base, the intellectual exhaustion of social democracy, if you like, its incapacity to come up with answers to the problems society is facing, particularly in the wake of the 2008 crash. So quite deep-lying factors, and the utter uselessness of Keir Starmer and his team. Morgan McSweeney imposed on Starmer, I think with Starmer's acquiescence, obviously, a plan you only focus on reform voters, or people who are reform curious, people, voters in the red wall, who actually Labour did not win back at all in 2024. Looking at overall, the performance in the red wall in 2024 was generally as bad, slightly better or worse than in 2019. It's only the division between reform and Tory meant that the right-wing vote was split, so they got all the seats back.
Because I'm a bit of a nerd, I actually sat down and worked this out. 2019 was the only time since the Second World War where the Labour percentage of seats was lower than the Labour Party percentage of the vote.
You've out-nerded me there. I wasn't aware of that fantastic fact. I think Labour roughly got the number of seats that it would have done had there been a perfect...
Yes, it's a fraction under. I think what we're saying here, when you really pick it apart, is that what happened under Jeremy is Labour got reduced to its irreducible core, essentially largely these seats in the large cities where they had enormous majorities. What they had lost was the sort of small towns in the Midlands and the North and so on. Now, what it seems to be now... What Morgan McSweeney's great achievement as chief of staff and as the architect of the modern Labour Party is to destroy the irreducible core.
Yes, he has. I mean, and in part it is because, for the first time, there is an alternative to Labour's left that is electorally credible. And McSweeney's strategy immediately collapses at that point. Labour's right wing have no answers at all. They won the leadership of the Labour Party by... as the title of the book says, fraud. They pretended Starmer was something he wasn't, and they could get away with that because he'd left such light political footprints in a brief political career. And they've been found out.
Andrew Murray, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week, but I'll just leave you with some final thoughts. In the run-up to this week's local elections, the mainstream parties and large parts of the media have gone full Corbyn on Zach Polanski and the Greens. It's almost impressive to watch the machine swing into action like this. The Times published an expose that felt like a ragbag of everything they could dredge up about the Green leader. My own reaction was, is that it? Is that all you've got? As with Corbyn, the main battering ram was anti-Semitism. To intervene in the debate over police handling of the Golders Green stabbings through a retweet was a misstep, and Polanski quickly acknowledged that. Other than that, much of the media spent the week scouring every comment every Green Council candidate has ever made about Jews or Israel. Israel is the Jewish state. It prides itself on being so. It is its whole raison d'etre. Frequently, you're told if you criticise Israel, you're criticising Jews. At present, Israel is committing genocide. People feel very, very strongly about this. The anguish and trauma of Palestinians in particular is almost unimaginable. Well over 21,000 of their children have been killed, after all.
Inevitably, amidst the hundreds of thousands of expressions of anger, there will be a small number of people who are not terribly sophisticated in how they express their rage. There may even be some, particularly among those who have personally suffered from Israeli brutality, who don't have the emotional sophistication to distinguish between Israelis and Jews in their own minds. Of course, straightforward anti-Semitism should be called out. But to make this the central point of focus at a time of genocide is absurd and serves to chill protest and is intended to do so. You may say, no, you're getting this all the wrong way round. This is all just a cover, an excuse, an opportunity. The real driving, animating force is anti-Semitism. But if that's what you really think, then in a time of genocide, that perhaps reveals something very profound about the way you relate to Palestinian humanity. It'll be fascinating to see just how effective all this has been. But as they look at the mainstream parties going into this election, people may think, is that really the best you have? Do you really not have anything positive to offer? Double Down Newswatch depends on you. We have no billionaire owners or sugar daddies. That's why we're independent. If you value the work we do, please subscribe to Double Down News through Patreon.